Welcome to Our Burning Questions, a professional learning podcast where we answer your most compelling questions about teaching, serving, and supporting multilingual learners. I'm your host, Jasmine Coaxum, and through our talks, I look forward to bringing the methods, philosophies, and stories behind teaching multilingual learners to light. Let's get into the show. So welcome, Dr. Marshall. It is such a pleasure to have you as my first guest as the new host of Our Burning Questions. Now, just to put our relationship into context for our listeners, I had the privilege of presenting with you at the TESOL convention last year, where you were also a keynote speaker, and of having your support as the MC of NICE TESOL's annual conference President's Dinner. And we've also worked together in the sense that I have framed a couple of my podcasting courses based on your approaches to online teaching. So I know that there are two important values that you basically bring to this space. There's a lot you bring to the space, but two important values that I'm going to talk about now, which is your desire to help students reach their full potential and your desire to mentor and collaborate with your colleagues. And so you create this kind of pay it forward ecosystem that really benefits everyone that comes into contact with you. So once again, I'm really excited to be speaking with you today.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's my pleasure to be here. And it's given me new energy and enthusiasm to work with you. So it's definitely mutual.
Oh, Lane. Oh, that's so nice. Okay. Well, we're going to dive in with your background. Well, actually, not with your background. Let's dive into your current role in education.
Okay. So actually, you're talking to me at a pivotal moment in my career, which is that I've actually just retired from my full-time position at Long Island University. And you can kind of look at this two ways, because actually, although the word retirement has to be used because I've been there 20 years and I'm actually under the formal designation of retiree. However, one of the reasons I did this is that I need more time to devote to my other professional endeavors. And my day job was eating up a lot of my time, and it's time for me to move on from that. So it's not really retirement in that sense. So how am I spending my time currently? I have two ongoing cases with the Department of Justice, and they're very happy that I'm retiring because they can use me more. These are wonderful opportunities to fight for equity and to assist districts who are well-intentioned but need a little push to serve their English learners, their multilingual learners, their emergent bilinguals, especially those who are struggling because they have issues around formal education, which we'll, I'm sure, get to later. The other thing that I'm doing with my time is consulting and working with the state of Connecticut, and just about to discuss work with Massachusetts and Pennsylvania around the issue that I just mentioned, equity for L's. So that's what I'm up to now.
Wow. That's great. I mean, you know, a lot of people think of retirement as, okay, I'm kind of just hanging everything up and I'm gonna, you know, put my feet up and kind of just relax and enjoy whatever other joys of life there are outside of career. But you are using it as an opportunity to really go deeper into the parts of this profession that you really care about, right? Of the field and of the people in it that you really care about. Are you at liberty to discuss either of the cases that you're currently helping with?
Well, recently, both of the cases settled. We have settlement agreements and we are in the monitoring phase in both cases. So my job now is to make sure that the districts are doing what the settlement agreement tells them to do. So yeah, I mean, it's, you know, these are districts that have a large influx of students that they're not used to handling, students who are newcomers, but they don't fit the pattern of English is the main thing they need. They're either from an indigenous population without a history of print literacy and formal education, or they may be refugees who have been spending years in camps and were unable to participate in education to the level that they need for their age. So we have settlement agreements around that, and we're taking a look at how they've improved their programs and services for ELLs. And they're, so far, we're happy with what we're seeing. So I can just say that, okay?
Yes. Okay. That's great. You know, this is a really important part of everything is when you take on something like trying to get a district to implement a certain practices, you know, making sure that there's follow-up with that, right? So that's great. Okay. Now, I'm going to just take it a couple of steps back now. Now that we know what you're currently doing, let's go back to what inspired you to become an educator of ELLs in the first place and kind of a little, just a little background on what led you to this field?
So I'm not going to tell a long story, and it could easily be one because it was a process. But to make it concise, I would say that I was always interested in languages and cultures. And I was a French major, and I went to live in France, and I taught English there. And when I did that, I realized I really enjoyed not just teaching French, but teaching English to French people. And so when I came back to the States, I went back to grad school and never looked back. I've been in TESOL ever since.
And we're so happy that that's the case. We're thrilled that that's the case. Okay, so obviously you wear many hats, but one of the, I guess I want to say approaches or frameworks that I really want to talk about today is SOFLA, or the Synchronous Online Flipped Learning Approach, which is how you and I really became acquainted, because I was really interested in finding a way to engage my students better online during the pandemic, of course, in 2020. And I saw you on a webinar. It was a nice TESOL webinar, and you were presenting SOFLA, and I just immediately was drawn to it. So I really would like to talk about how you came up with this concept, and first, really, what is it for anyone who is not aware of it?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting how it's caught on. I think part of it is the fact that people just like saying SOFLA. Anyway, what happened was I didn't even call it SOFLA. I'd been doing it. And let's back up. I learned about flipped learning many years ago, early in flipping. You know, as you just said, when you saw my presentation right away, you were like, oh, I gotta know more about this. I felt the same way when I first heard about flipped learning in 2011. And then I also separately was teaching online because of a cross-campus program I was involved in. And I decided that the two could go together. We can do flipped learning and we can do online learning. And I wondered how to make that happen. And when I developed it, I had a partner. I always like to mention her when anyone asks me how SOFLA came to be, because without bouncing ideas off of this other person, I don't know if it would actually look like it looks today. And so her name is Carolina Rodriguez Buitrago. She's in Bogota. And she's actually been writing also with me and on her own about SOFLA. So I just wanted to put that out there for people who want to follow up. And one of the things about SOFLA is that it addresses the issue of whether online learning is cold or warm. That was my first presentation title. Is it cold or is it warm when you teach online? And SOFLA helps create that warm feeling, that social presence that people are looking for when they're online so they feel connected. I can tell you more about it, but that's the general response to your question.
Okay, now you said that you didn't call it SOFLA at first.
Yeah, that's right. Because I didn't know it needed a name. It was just the way I taught, and I didn't expect anyone else to be interested or want to learn about it. It was just the way I taught online. And the more I presented the way I taught online, the more I realized I had something here and decided to give it a name. So the name just jumped out at me because, you know, you need some consonants and some vowels if you're going to have an acronym. So O was easy because it's online, and flipped learning was easy, FL. So I have my O, my F, and my L, and I realized that everything except the flip part is synchronous. That's another piece that we'll talk about. This is not an asynchronous model. This is synchronous. And so I needed an S. And then, you know, A for approach. So boom, there it was, SOFLA.
Fantastic. Okay. So I am, of course, familiar with SOFLA, and I know that there are 8 steps. So do you want to kind of dive into more about SOFLA? How can someone implement this in their online classroom settings?
Yeah, well, actually, it's one of these approaches that's easy but deceptive in that it looks easier than it is. Sure, you follow the steps, but we have found, those of us doing SOFLA have found that it's very easy to oversimplify it and miss the point of a given step. And in fact, Ilka Koska, who writes with me about SOFLA, and I have just completed an article. It should be coming out in March, I think, in a new journal, Advances in Online Learning. And it clarifies the steps and talks about misconceptions. So we're getting to the point now that people are just starting to use SOFLA so widely, in fact, internationally, that we've followed up with people to discover that we need to clarify. So I just wanted to say that ahead of time so that people are aware that they need to really pay attention to the 8 steps. So when you mentioned the steps, that's actually what makes SOFLA unique. Most online learning doesn't focus on pedagogy. It focuses more on tools, or even activities, but simply doing a string of activities without thinking about the integration of these activities into a pedagogical approach. I feel as though that all had to be said before I decided to, you know, go into actually the steps. Did you have a question at this point, or?
I'm really grateful that you've provided that little bit of background before going into this. Yes, before going into the steps.
Okay, great. All right. So the steps actually can be rolled out very quickly if I just say them. But if anyone really wants to understand them, you know, they need to go into, as I said, you know, more depth. So the first step is the flip. So it's pre-work, and the students do pre-work out of class. And that's pretty classic and traditional. So what I do is my preference, but it doesn't really matter how you do the pre-work as long as it's interactive and that, you know, the students are accountable. So then they come into class and we start with a sign-in, which is also accountability, and you give them feedback on it. And the sign-in should be an open-ended prompt so they can see each other's responses. Then there's an application step, which is whole group application, and they work collaboratively in that step to go deeper into the content that they first were exposed to out of class. And then they go into breakout rooms, which is simply group work, but again, with accountability. And they come out of the breakout rooms and share. And the sharing is something that they have a document for, or they can do it just orally. And there's a very important feedback piece from the rest of the class called SHAC that is part of the sharing step. Share, help, ask, and comment is what the rest of the class does. So it's not just people presenting and everybody just waiting for their turn. And then the sixth step, if you're counting, we're up to six. The sixth step is probably the key in my mind to SOFLA and what makes it different from other flipped approaches and other online teaching and learning is called preview and discovery. So what this does is acknowledge the reality that students aren't always excited about doing work outside of class. And this gets them excited about doing the work outside of class because it's the movie trailer step. So you show them something really cool that they're going to learn. You pre-teach vocabulary in our case, because we work with language learners. You might front load some important concepts that might stump them. You can even teach a concept. This piece is the only real teacher-centered piece. And it's important for the teacher to actually prepare them both cognitively and affectively for what's going to come next. So that's preview. Is that step six? And then step seven is simply giving the assignment. You just have to make sure that you're very clear, explicit, redundant in the way you present it, by not just saying it during the synchronous session, but having asynchronous access for the students. And then when they leave the class, just as they signed in, they kind of sign out, but I call it a reflection. I want them to look back at the lesson and tell me what resonated with them. And I get a lot of good data from that too, as to my own teaching and what became intake for them as students, individual students. They sign their names with the reflection and the sign-in, obviously. Those are the steps. Okay, did you count to eight? Okay.
Okay, so of course, some of our listeners might have a couple of questions about these steps. So I'm just going to ask some questions that I think might be on our listeners' minds. For example, when you mentioned step one, the flipped aspect, the pre-work, usually when people think about pre-work, they think, okay, well, students are, maybe they're going to read something, maybe listen to something. But you mentioned this word, which is very important, interactive, that the pre-work must be interactive. And so how can we make that happen as educators? How can we make pre-work interactive?
All right. Well, it depends on the mode you're using. If you're using videos, there are great tools for that. Edpuzzle is probably the most favorite of K-12 folks. I use another one. It's called PlayPosit, although I think they were just bought by somebody else, but they do still exist. But in any case, these are applications where you can, as an instructor, can insert. You can stop the video and insert interactions. So any kind of question you want to ask, closed-ended or open-ended, you can even have a discussion going alongside. All of this is asynchronous. And you can get the data to see how the students did with these interactions. So that's one way to have interactions. Some people like to wait until the end of the video, but I like to bring the interactions right to an embedded spot in the video to keep them paying attention. I just snap my fingers. I do that sometimes. I was thinking of, you know, for the students, keep them all paying attention. Okay. So that's that. And then the other one, which most people don't even know about, and this gets us into advances in tech, which I want to mention something else about that later. But you know that you can do shared readings online. So you all get the same electronic copy of the textbook or the passage they're reading or the handout. You can upload PDFs. And what you do is on the side next to the material that you're reading, the students can respond to your questions. They can ask questions. They can actually use SHAC, share, help, ask, and comment. And there's a lively interaction going on among the students. They're actually reading what each other writes. This is asynchronous. Although in these applications, if they happen to be there at the same time, they can actually have a conversation. The one I use, there are many of them, but the one I use is Perusal, but there are others, Hypothesis, Active Textbook, there's some other ones. But anyway, those are ideas of how to make pre-work interactive.
Okay, great. I'm even noting some of these down, some of these particular like Hypothesis. Yeah, this sounds great. Okay. So another question that I had with regard to the steps. Now you mentioned that step six was the key. And step six again is preview and discovery. And now you mentioned this kind of movie trailer aspect to this particular step. So why do you think this actually works in motivating students to want to do their homework assignment?
Well, I think they don't, it's a little bit of FOMO. So, you know, they don't want to miss out if their peers are going to see it. And then they're going to come to class and they say, oh, did you see that cartoon? Or, you know, you put funny things in your pre-work. And, you know, or did you see when she said this or that or whatever? So I think fear of missing out is part of it. I also think that if you, you know, basically they want to learn. And if you put out there something that they might really want to know, but you don't give them all of it, you give them just a piece, then that sparks their curiosity to learn the rest of what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, it might say, for example, do you know that you can group the irregular past tense into categories and it makes them easier to learn? Mm-hmm. Well, in this video, you're going to learn what the categories are. So you can sort your past tense verbs and you'll never have to worry about what they are. You'll learn them that way. See, and then they'll go and listen. That's an example.
Okay, great. So obviously this podcast is geared towards L's, but I mean, do you think that SOFLA is also effective for content teachers?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I mean, I go to the point to say that it's only because I happen to be in TESOL that most of the articles and examples and my presentations focus on language learners. But actually, flipped learning itself is very popular in the STEM areas. And everybody can use flipped learning and everybody can use online learning. And so SOFLA can be generic. It can be used with any age group, any subject area, because it doesn't have content to it. The instructor brings the content. This is a template of steps, can be used by any educator. In fact, I also, just to put it out there, think it could be used in corporate training, which isn't our concern today, but I'm trying to demonstrate how broad the application can be for SOFLA.
Okay. And on that note, since it does kind of have a broad range of applications. Why should teachers of ELLES specifically choose this approach?
Okay, well, one of the things I say when I talk about SOFLA is that it creates fertile spaces for online learning of language. And, you know, online learning of language is tricky because you're not, language works best with nonverbal communication mixed in and all of the elements of being together as people, because it's communication. And when you are not physically with people, that inhibits a little bit what you're able to do, what you're motivated to do in terms of communicating, especially if it's a language you're not comfortable in. So I think what SOFLA does is, and I alluded to this earlier, is it creates what is referred to in the online literature. Garrison Anderson and Archer talk about this in their community of inquiry. It's called social presence. So it creates social presence because the steps are, they're structured, but they're interactive and they're multimodal. So students are much more likely to participate because they're both high stakes and low stakes ways to do so. And because everything is done in a way that that their peers can be with them in the space. And it's not always the instructor who's doing the talking, who's taking over. If you follow the steps, it gives you, you're still an authority figure, but you're not controlling everything so much. And when the students can feel more empowered and that they're more in control in the interactions, and they know the steps and they know what's coming, then they're more confident in their use of this new language they're learning. So that's how I would explain that.
Okay, yes. And also with their peers, this really contributes to the idea of accountability and making students more accountable, because they also know that their peers are going to be paying attention to what they're doing and that they're kind of collaborating in a sense. So, okay, great.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned fertile spaces, which I was listening to you on another podcast, and you mentioned this metaphor of students as plants. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because I think it's really relevant to teachers of ELLES in terms of the way that they approach their students.
Yes, well, the idea of plants actually was not mine. And I want to give credit to Pamela Broussard, who talks, and you can look at her website. It's called Leading ELLES, Leading ELLES. And I heard her give a talk. And I think we all cross-fertilize in our field. I think it's healthy that way. T-cells very healthy that way, in that we listen and learn from each other. So she talks about these wildflowers that she tried to replant in her house, and they didn't survive. And she realized when she went to ask those who were more knowledgeable about how to transition plants from the outdoors and in areas where they were growing freely to bringing them as houseplants. And she learned that what you have to do is use some of the original soil, because that's where they grew and that's where they're comfortable. And if you just uproot them and try and replant them, even if the soil you're providing is very rich and has all that it needs, fertilizer and water and sun and everything else, it's not going to work. And so I think that really applies to our students, because they've been uprooted one way or another. And if we don't keep some of the original soil, then I think that's going to be much harder for them. And that's the metaphor I use when I talk about creating fertile spaces. And that's why the word fertile is used. We need to create the conditions that are going to make them feel that they can learn in this new environment. And that's even more true when they're online, because that's probably not how they had their formative years of learning. So it's extremely important, as getting back to the social presence, that we make them feel very comfortable. And that's why my other work, which I guess we'll talk about later, we're still on SOFLA now, my other work is so important, because it's mutually adaptive and culturally sustaining. So that's what the plant metaphor is all about. Okay.
So I have just a couple more questions with regard to SOFLA before we move on to some of your other work. So first, you mentioned that there's an international presence of SOFLA, which is great. And I'm wondering which countries as of now have actually adopted this.
Well, you're having me go to my phone and try and, I actually have a list. I'm afraid I'd leave out a country and they'd say, you didn't mention. Okay. So So SOFLA list. So I'm going to tell you the countries. So definitely Japan. There's huge interest in SOFLA in Japan at the elementary level, secondary and higher ed. I've presented at JALT several times, and some of my former students are really working in Japan to spread SOFLA. India, believe it or not, yes, also. I've done talks in India and several different places. Uttaranchal University comes to mind, and they're very interested in India in this. Colombia, of course, because that's where Carolina is. And there's a lot going on with SOFLA there. I'm going to just mention a few places where research is being done. Australia, the Czech Republic, where I actually went to Prague and gave a keynote talk there. Lebanon, there are researchers there. France, Mexico, there's a researcher down there. And actually, the place that I first talked about it internationally is Morocco. Back in 2017, I went to a conference in Morocco, the IRN conference, and I presented SOFLA there. So those are some of the countries so far where people are talking about SOFLA. And I have a list of researchers, people doing their dissertations on it, and they're mostly not in the United States. So if you're in the U.S. and you're interested in SOFLA, let me know, because you can be part of this this list of researchers that I maintain. Thank you for that question.
Yeah, of course. Well, I mean, I consider this to be an international community, whether you're from the U.S. or not, because you are essentially teaching students who are not from the U.S. And so, you know, it's really important to understand that international piece and how this is really reaching so many people and so many different parts of the world and so many cultures. So, another question that I have is there a way that people can learn how to implement this approach?
Okay. All right. Now, here's the thing. It depends on how you like to learn. Mm-hmm. So what you can do, if you want to learn more about SOFLA, we have the traditional route, which is journal articles. So, I mean, that's what you can do. So if you want to go that route, you can probably find these, by Google. But the Tessel EJ, which you might be familiar with, published one of our articles in August 2020. It's on the internet, which was Vance Stevens. We've just lost him. But Vance Stevens maintained on the internet, And Ilka Koska and I wrote an article about SOFL. It goes through the steps. It talks about the rationale. It's a great article. I mean, I'm just saying it is for people who want to learn about SOFL. That's more of a traditional journal article. The other article I was going to suggest, I mean, there's several out there, but the other one I want to suggest is very practical, very short, very easy to read, and has an actual classroom example in it. And that one will appeared in spring of 2021 in the Notes from the Field online magazine of Prolingual Learning. So that would be good. That was just written only by me. So you could find that online too. Those would be the two articles I'd recommend. The other way to go is YouTube. So there are publicly available videos of me using Prezi video, which is kind of fun in and of itself. There's a 6-minute one, a 15-minute one. So you can find them online very easily. The third route is just use the HyperDoc. Heather Rubin came up with the HyperDoc. She's actually at an Arburn herself, the Long Island Arburn. And Heather works with me on SOFL regularly. And she's our rubric HyperDoc person. And she has this wonderful HyperDoc that gives the 8 steps with the opportunity to create a student-facing document with links. So that actually, that HyperDoc is available. It's anyone who has the link, but if you just want to see how to access it quickly, you could get it from the Prolingual Learning article where we present the HyperDoc. So that's one way to get it. Okay, so those would be the three ways that I can think of off the bat for quickly learning. You can also just contact me. It's another one.
Okay, thank you for providing so many different avenues for people to go deeper into this approach and really be able to bring it to their students. So one last question that I have is, of course, you know, now that the pandemic is pretty much I want to say wrapping up. I'd like to say wrapping up. Finished. People are kind of going back to quote unquote business as usual. What do you think about people who might want to somehow implement SOFL, but who are now returning into the classroom? What are their elements of SOFL they can bring with them? What can they do now?
Oh, actually, that's a great question. And it's one that I've given a lot of thought to. In fact, Heather and I are going to be talking about SOFL in hybrid learning.
Excellent. I can't wait to hear about this. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. And what do you do when everyone isn't online or everyone isn't in person? And one of the things that comes to mind is that even though it's called SOFL and the word online is there, it can be this cycle of learning. It's a learning cycle, and it can certainly be adapted to any learning situation. Even in person, it can be used. And the idea that it has to be online is not really the case. It helps people who are teaching online to do so. But there's no reason why it can't be transplanted, to use the plant thing again. There's no reason it can't be transplanted to other learning contexts. Because when you think about it, people are always using devices. So anything that you think will work better with a device, they can still use the device. I mean, there are classrooms all the time where devices are used. I mean, even something simple as a smart document where everybody's sharing, say on a Google Doc, you can project it onto a screen in a real room in the class, the classroom. So a lot of the collaborative work that's done online can be done in person and everyone can see it. And you can certainly still do breakouts and share out. The instructor can preview the next pre-work. You can maintain the integrity of the model and still have students in the live classroom. And even if you have some students who are not able to make it into the classroom, you can have them participate from a distance because you've built the structure of the steps with the electronic options. So this can work actually very well in other kinds of mixed, hybrid, blended, in-person, whatever. It works.
Great, because I feel like this is the trend right now in education, right? Just having a multimodal experience, not necessarily just online or even just in the classroom, but really, truly kind of blending those experiences. So it's excellent that SOFLA basically carries into that as well. Now I'm finally going to switch gears a little bit and talk about some of your other work, particularly MALP, as it pertains to SLIFE, since you have been called a SLIFE expert. So tell us a little bit about MALP.
Yes, well, I just, again, want to frame it. Mm-hmm. So the first thing I'd say is that whoever's listening to this podcast, you may have never heard of me before. And so I'm the SOFLA person. Well, you know, life is funny that way because we tend to think of people based on how we first encountered them, whether it's personally or professionally. And so what's interesting is that SOFLA is this brand new thing that I got into in the last 10 years of my career. But for many, many, many years before that, I was in a very different place where I was known for, as you mentioned, MALP, which is the mutually adaptive learning paradigm that I developed in the late, believe it or not, late 80s, early 90s, way back. And that was an approach that I developed long before anyone talked about SLIFE, students with limited or interrupted formal education. There was no acronym for these students. And I was working in Wisconsin with the Hmong refugees. And I realized that what they needed was not only English, there was something blocking them from succeeding. And I started reading everything I could get my hands on. And from scratch, I developed a model that understands where students are coming from when they have not participated in formal education and they come from cultures that are primarily oral and very collectivistic. And our whole society here, particularly, you know, right here in the U.S., is very individualistic and print-based, literacy-based, right? And we have formal education that is gatekeeping all the way. You can't go. You have to go from grade to grade. You have to pass tests, and you're constantly accountable individually. This was anathema to the Hmong refugees that I met in Wisconsin. And so I decided rather than teach them the way we're used to teaching, what if we found out, you know, how they learn and figure that out and bring that along again with the original soil? So I developed this mutually adaptive approach, and it takes pieces of their orality, their collectivism, their informal way of learning. Pieces of that come into the MALP approach, along with pieces that we can't compromise on. Obviously, they need to master the basics of reading and writing, and they have to be able to pass these tests. They have to think a certain way in order to pass the tests. So all of that is built into MALP. MALP takes from both sides in order to bring them to where they can be successful in the new setting. And I think creating fertile spaces, again, to go back to that phrase, encapsulates the philosophy of MALP. And it's a deep view of culture. That's why the word culture is problematic, because people think of it as, oh, Hmong culture, Somali culture, K'iche culture. These are some of the groups I've worked with. And whether they're Somali or K'iche or Hmong, sure, very different, different languages, different backgrounds. But in terms of MALP, they all need MALP. And many struggling learners, I believe, along the continuum of ways of learning could better reach their potential if we approached teaching this way in a mutually adaptive manner. There are probably many students in your classes who are getting by okay, but if we really did a culturally responsive and sustaining approach with them, they might achieve a lot more. So I'm about more than only SLIF, just to say, because I think MALP has much more to contribute to the larger conversation around linguistically and culturally diverse learners than it's been given credit for to date. So there you are.
Okay. So when you, yes, I mean, of course, it's great that MALP can be used in the larger context. I mean, that people can kind of think of this paradigm in the larger context of teaching, of education in general, whether it be K through 12 or whether it be even beyond that, really. But going back to what you said about in the U.S., this idea of individualisticness versus the way that maybe other cultures process learning, you've said that particularly the SLIF population of students learn in a context of relationships. You mentioned something before on another podcast somewhere that one of your students actually said, "Now I know you, I can learn from you." And
yes.
Mm-hmm. I think that now more than in the past, we're emphasizing the importance of interconnectedness here in the U.S. in terms of education. Maybe it's more targeted towards L's right now, but I think that it's something that is spreading and just becoming more of an important piece when we talk about education. So, you know, we really emphasize now getting to know our students and their backgrounds and what they bring to the table, not only academically, but also culturally. And the question really is, how much of that are we modeling as educators in terms of allowing our students to get to know us in a way that makes them feel more comfortable learning from us? And I guess my question really is, what does it mean to know us as educators in order to facilitate that interconnectedness? And how did you facilitate this in your classes?
Yes. Well, I think the biggest way that this can happen is through MALP projects. And in MALP, we teach through projects. And all of the projects have personal elements to them. So the way that you develop the project is starting with yourselves, and the instructor is one of the people in the room. So let's say that your project is a survey project. Well, the instructor is going to answer the questions on the survey too, and the students will learn about the instructor that way. The survey project is a prototypical MALP project. And surveys are great for learning about a particular topic that the students want to know more about, whether it's a personal topic or relates to the subject matter. And the survey gives them a chance to develop questions, and they can use questions to interview the instructor and interview each other. And it speaks to developing relationships, as you said. But at the same time, it helps them develop critical thinking skills and helps them to think about analyzing data, which they collect when they do the survey. It's just a wonderful project, and it's only one example of how MALP, when it's implemented, can promote that interconnectedness you're talking about.
And it also seems like, I mean, obviously projects like this keep students engaged, right?
Yes.
And something else that I heard you say is that they always say you should have 150% ready to go and then only give 100%. So first, who is this they? Okay. And whoever they are, I love that philosophy. So what do you think it is that educators, this 150% that educators should come prepared with to create the most engaging atmosphere?
So that's a really interesting question when you say prepared. And I'm not totally sure I understand the question, but I think the best thing is to not make assumptions and be ready to learn from your students. Be ready to co-create the syllabus, co-create the projects, and follow their lead as to what their priorities are, and combine their priorities with what you know you're being paid to do. Obviously, it's a job. So that's the main mindset I think you need in terms of preparation. In terms of other types of preparation, I think the more one knows about how to access information in today's world, the better. I still go into classrooms where folks are just grabbing something off the internet, passing it out in class, commercial worksheets, without much thought. And I think that teachers need to really do some research as they prepare for their instruction and make sure that what they have selected for their students really resonates or will likely resonate with the students, and they should feel free to adapt and tweak and, as I said, co-create materials with their students. I don't know how the publishers feel about that, but also to select the published materials that most likely will match with the needs of their students, because there's a lot out there today that may or may not resonate with their class. So that's something else.
Right. I mean, you said that you weren't sure about the question, but you most certainly answered it. I mean, the main thing was, how can educators bring that 150%, right? And so you definitely have answered that. I guess I would like to kind of bring attention to the fact that you have co-authored three different books, and of course you've written numerous articles. So for people who are interested in continuing to follow what you're doing with all of the time now that you can dedicate, now that you are retired from the quote unquote day job, where can people find information about your work? And do you have anything that is coming up soon in terms of books, projects, publications, et cetera, that you would really like to make the audience aware of?
Sure, absolutely. I do have a book coming out. It may or may not be ready for TESOL, but it's definitely coming out in the spring. It's the second edition of Breaking New Ground. And I'm pleased that the new edition will have MALP in the title. Mutually mm-hmm. Adaptive Learning Paradigm will be part of the title. It's co-written with Andrea DiCapua, my partner in crime for the books that I've written to date. And what's amazing about this new edition I know everyone always says, oh, the new edition, get the new edition. But I really mean it, because what we have now is many teachers out in the field who've been implementing MALP over the last 10 years. And we have collected the very best projects. And I think I would be remiss if I didn't mention that, Yasmin, your project is in our book. So Yasmin's podcasting project is one of the ones that we've selected. And we do have off-the-shelf projects. You can actually read them and adapt them to your context. But even if you don't adapt, you can just take the projects. They're in there from start to finish. And that's definitely a plus of the second edition, because in the first edition, that was not the case. So get the second edition. It will be out in the spring. It's published by University of Michigan Press. So that's the main item that's coming out, in addition to the article I mentioned earlier in the new journal, Advances in Online Learning, which is a SOFLA article. The other thing is I am about to embark on a SOFLA book. I suppose this is the first time I have publicly mentioned that. So now I got to do it, right?
All right. We got an exclusive, listeners. We got an exclusive. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. So I think it's time for a book to guide people. It'll be a handbook to guide people through the 8 steps of SOFLA and give them examples of how to implement SOFLA in different contexts. And I'm very excited about that book. I'll be writing it with Heather Rubin and Carolina Rodriguez-Bitrago, both of whom I have mentioned earlier in our conversation. So that's kind of what I'm up to. If people want to find me, I have a website, of course. Is that what you were also asking? Or if
of course, any ways yes. that they can follow you are great. So, yes.
Great. Okay. So, so my website is malpeducation.com. So MALP education, all one word kind of written out. That's the website. There's also a Facebook page for SOFLA, Facebook/SOFLA Model. So it's SOFLAMODEL, SOFLA Model. And that's a Facebook page where I post everything about SOFLA. And our books, if you look up our books, each one also has a Facebook page. So those are the ways to keep up with me online.
All right, Dr. Marshall. It's been so great talking with you today. It's always a delight, and I'm sure our listeners have gained so much from this conversation. But I have one final question.
Okay. So,
what burning question should today's educators consider in order to improve their service to the L community?
Well, I saw that in the preview to the podcast, I saw that question and I had to give it some thought, but it only took me a second and it popped into my head. The obvious burning question, because of what we've all been reading and seeing in the last couple of months about AI, and how can we not call that our burning question? So the question is, how to navigate the interface and the tension between our humanity as people communicating in using language with ChatGPT and other AI tools that are also not going away anytime soon. And I believe that the face of English language teaching is about to pivot and shift and change, and we're going to need to keep up with it and navigate it. We can't put our heads in the sand, and that's the burning issue, is can we leverage it in a positive way, and can we meet the challenges that it presents to us as educators of English learners? That's the burning question.
All right. And that is an excellent question for our listeners to simmer on. All right. So thank you so much again, Dr. Marshall, for being on our show. And everyone is looking forward. We're definitely looking forward to the projects that you mentioned and to hearing more from you about the projects that you're working on and about your work.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure talking with you. And even though I thought I had some ideas about how to speak with you on these issues, your questions motivated me to think more deeply and think further. And I've been taking notes on my own conversation.
So mutual learning happening here. Mutual learning. Okay. Yes. Thank you so much, Dr. Marshall.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Our Burning Questions, produced by Mid-State Auburn at OCM BOCES. If you would like to learn more about today's guest or any of the resources we discussed, please visit Mid-State Auburn's webpage at ocmboces.org. That's ocmboces.org. Join us next time where we hope to answer more of your burning questions.